From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Mumia Abu-Jamal is in court again. The court hears testimony from a woman who says the key prosecution witness was forced to lie.
First, she said that Cynthia White testified under fear for her life, and that was never presented to the jury. Secondly, she said that Cynthia White was an informant, and that information was never given to the defense. That should get a new trial right there. Thirdly, she said they're hiding Cynthia White, who we've been looking for 2 years.
But the prosecution says Cynthia White has been dead for 5 years. The U.S. Conference of Mayors calls for democracy in Nigeria. And will Medicare become managed care? We'll take a look. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court has found no constitutional right to doctor-assisted suicide. In a pair of unanimous decisions involving bans in New York and Washington, the court effectively kept the practice illegal because almost all states have similar laws. At the same time, several justices emphasized doctors can take steps to relieve terminal patients' pain, even if that speeds death. The court also ruled 7-2 that a ban on internet pornography in last year's overhaul of telecommunications laws was an unconstitutional infringement on free speech. Justices also dismissed 7-2 a challenge to the line item veto by 6 members of Congress. Meanwhile, the House has approved a $135 billion package of tax cuts by a vote of 253-179. The bill would provide benefits to families with young children and college-bound students, but also cut the capital gains tax rate for individuals to 20% from 28% and reward big corporations subject to the minimum tax. The administration issued fresh warnings that it views the measure as unfairly skewed to the wealthy. Newt Gingrich, lacking a veto-proof majority, hinted at Republican flexibility. Meanwhile, in New York at the United Nations, trying to silence worldwide criticism, President Clinton pledged yesterday to help bridle the real and imminent threat of global warming, but rebuffed European demands to take action. Painting a gloomy picture of rising oceans, droughts, and deadly heat, the president told the United Nations Earth Summit, "The silence is clear and compelling. We humans are changing the global climate." The European Union proposes cutting greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide by 15% below 1990 levels, with a deadline of 2010. Under pressure from corporate lobbyists and lawmakers, Clinton has refused to commit to targets before the treaty talks in Kyoto, Japan. Oklahoma City police have confiscated an Academy Award-winning film from 6 video stores in at least one home. Civil rights activists are calling for a federal investigation over the seizure of the German film Tin Drum after a judge ruled it was obscene. The movie won the 1979 Oscar for Best Foreign Film. It's a story of Nazi Germany as seen through the eyes of a young boy. In one scene, a boy of about 6 or 7 has oral sex in a bathhouse with a teenage girl. The Walt Disney Company has recalled an estimated 100,000 copies of a new obscenity-laced hip-hop album from store shelves this week, days after Southern Baptist launched a morality boycott against the entertainment giant. Disney officials said Insane Clown Posse's The Great Malenko slipped through the company's review system and had nothing to do with the boycott. Baptist, however, declared a victory. The Great Malenko, by a white duo who claimed to be former gang members, is a blend of rock and hip-hop music laced with lyrics that graphically describe incest and necrophilia. And Betty Shabazz will be laid to rest following an Islamic funeral in New York today. The widow of Malcolm X died Monday from severe burns she suffered in a fire on June 1st. Mourners spoke of Shabazz's warmth and the courage it took to raise her 6 daughters after her husband, Malcolm X, was assassinated in 1965. A public ecumenical memorial service will be held in Manhattan on Sunday. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez, a columnist with the New York Daily News. Welcome, Juan.
Good day to you, Amy.
Well, I rushed out yesterday to the Mumia Abu-Jamal court case hearing in Philadelphia, but I did get a chance to see the headline on your column in the New York Daily News yesterday, Juan. You were continuing to follow the tobacco deal story. The latest is David Kessler, who's head of the commission, that will be evaluating the tobacco deal struck between tobacco giants like Philip Morris and Brown & Williamson and Lorillard Company and the state attorneys general, as well as some health groups. They're evaluating it and apparently extremely critical of it.
Yes, and I think, Amy, one of the things that has not gotten a lot of attention, and there have been a couple of articles in the Washington Post on it and some in Florida, is the tremendous number of politically connected folks who are involved in these negotiations and who stand to benefit financially in an enormous way from the proposed settlement as it is now. Of course, we mentioned a few days ago that Richard Scruggs, who's the main negotiator from a law firm for the, there are about 60 class action law firms that joined together with the attorneys general to negotiate this, and he was the lead negotiator on that side. And Scruggs, of course, is the brother-in-law of Trent Lott, the majority leader in the Senate. He's married to the his wife is the sister of Trent Lott's sister, and Trent Lott's wife. I'm sorry. And then you've got on the you've got Hugh Rodham Jr., Hillary Clinton's little brother, who was brought in at the last moment to represent I'm sorry, he represents the class action lawyers. Scruggs is negotiating on behalf of the attorneys general. Scruggs, the group that Scruggs represents, stands to make a 10% fee on the money that the states recoup. The states will be recouping supposedly $100 billion. So you're looking out over the lifetime of this settlement, if it goes the way it is, the lawyers will take in $10 billion. It's the largest.
The lawyers. Not the plaintiffs.
The lawyers will take in $10 billion as their fee for getting this money for the states. And on Rodham's end, the class action attorneys who agreed that there will be no more class action suits and who will never have to take any of their class action suits to court stand to make as much possibly as $18 billion. So you're looking at the biggest payday in legal history is involved in these suits. But on the other side, if you look at the tobacco industry, you've got people like such card-carrying liberals as Ann Richards, who the former governor of Texas, who was a lobbyist for the industry and will be hopefully pushing this through Congress, and George Mitchell, the former Senate Majority Leader, also working for the tobacco industry, all of them working to get this settlement through. And they're all going to make big paydays as a result of it if it goes through in the way that it is set at this point.
Well, these aren't the kind of facts that we get very much in talking about this settlement. We just hear that it is a historic settlement. But you always have to follow where the money is, no question about that. And Juan, you're headed off to Mexico.
Yes, I leave for the elections that are coming up. It'll be on July 6th, an incredibly important election. It hasn't gotten too much attention, but in the next week or so, you'll be seeing a lot more. There is a major upset about to occur. The leader of the PRD, the most progressive party in Mexico, is way in the lead to capture the mayorship of Mexico City, which has never had a mayor before and could conceivably become the second most powerful politician in the country. This is part of the by-elections in Mexico because the presidential elections won't be for another 3 years.
Do you think Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas would be allowed to take office like he wasn't in 1988? I guess PRI is in a much weaker position now.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that both the PRI, the governing party, and also the PAN, the right-wing party, which many in the United States expected to become the new ruling party if the PRI ever lost, have both been hurt tremendously by the 1994 peso devaluation crisis, because the PAN, even though it was an opposition party, was always strongly supportive of NAFTA and the government's economic policies. And so now the population has turned not only against the ruling PRI party as a result of this incredible crisis that has driven down living standards and created immense unemployment, but also against the PAN, which supported that policy, the only party that opposed NAFTA, that opposed the whole economic program of the Mexican establishment, was the PRD, and it is now benefiting from the discontent of the Mexican people.
And Mexico is becoming more and more significant in terms of doing business with the United States.
Yes, it's supposedly by this year it will pass Japan to become the second largest trading partner of the United States after Canada.
Well, Juan, as I was saying yesterday, after Democracy Now!, I headed off to Philadelphia to the Court of Common Pleas, where Mumia Abu-Jamal was making a rare appearance. The Pennsylvania death row prisoner appeared in court yesterday, this time to hear the testimony of Pamela Jenkins. She says that Cynthia White, the star prosecution witness against Mumia Abu-Jamal, was forced by the Philadelphia police under threat to her life to give false testimony at Mumia's trial back in 1982. Pamela Jenkins also alleged that the Philadelphia police were keeping Cynthia White in hiding to this day. But in a bombshell revelation yesterday afternoon, the prosecution said Cynthia White has been dead for 5 years. Joining us right now to talk about all that happened yesterday, the case will continue in court on Monday, is Leonard Weinglass, who's the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Len.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, why don't we start off by you telling us just who Pamela Jenkins is and why she ended up back in Judge Szabo's court yesterday.
Well, Pamela Jenkins was a central figure in the 39th District Police scandal, which developed in 1995, when she came forward to say that she worked as an informant and a paid informant for the police officers of that particular district. As a result of that revelation, and she testified before a federal grand jury, six officers were indicted for various things, of not only the use of Pamela Jenkins, but other things that surfaced as well. And they've all been convicted or pled guilty. So she has credibility. She was a working prostitute at the time. We then found Pamela Jenkins and asked her if she had any involvement in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She readily said she did, that she was questioned about Jamal's case. She implied that she was threatened. She was told that she should lie, as the other prostitute, her friend Cynthia White, did. And that she resisted that pressure, and she was saved only because her boyfriend was a Philadelphia police officer. She also revealed that Cynthia White told her that she testified against Mumia under threat of death from the police. So we put Pamela Jenkins on the stand to establish both of those factors.
And how did she end up back there? Can you tell us what's happening at the state Supreme Court?
Well, when we interviewed Pamela Jenkins in January, when she was in jail and she told us this, we had no way of knowing this previously. And so we got an affirmation, a signed statement from her. We presented that to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, which is considering Mumia's appeal. When the Supreme Court examined her affirmation, they then ordered the case remanded back to the trial level so that the testimony of Pamela Jenkins could be taken.
What was the reaction of the district attorney's representatives? Did they attempt to question her about her statements? And
yes, they did. Actually, they cross-examined her not as extensively as they thought they would, but they questioned her, and they really laid the foundation for a series of documents that they put into evidence to rebut her testimony. And they put those documents into evidence, including the death certificate that Amy referred to in the afternoon.
So let's talk about that. What Pamela Jenkins said about Cynthia White, that she was forced to give the testimony she did at the trial and that it wasn't true, and that she is alive today. What is this death certificate?
Well, the death certificate is something that the prosecutor claimed they came into possession of since the Supreme Court ordered this hearing on May 30th of 97, which is somewhat suspicious right there, because according to the death certificate they presented, Cynthia White allegedly died in 1992 just across the river in Camden County. They claim they were looking for her for the last 2.5 years. It's really remarkable that if a district attorney's office expends considerable resources looking for someone for 2.5 years, they didn't know that there was a death certificate lodged across the river in Camden County during all that time for the person they were allegedly looking for. So we question the validity of the death certificate.
Now, did they have any responsibility having discovered this? I mean, unless they discovered it yesterday or the day before, did they have any responsibility to notify you beforehand that they'd found this out?
Well, they had no responsibility to do that on, actually. But the point is, a good DA's office would have done it. But in Philadelphia, they don't follow practices such as that. Instead, they kind of lie in wait, let you put on your case, and then spring what they think will be a surprise. But actually, it wasn't a surprise. We knew of this death certificate for the last 5-6 months.
And?
And our investigator, who found the death certificate, examined the entire record, and what he found was that this individual who died in Camden apparently must have died with papers indicating that she was Cynthia White. Those were the identification papers on her. But they never fingerprinted that person, and they immediately listed her as Cynthia White. They cremated the body, and they never notified the next of kin so they could come down and make a positive identification. I should amend that to say they did notify the next of kin, but did it in such a way as to discourage their coming from New York down to Camden to make the identification. We did contact the next of kin, and we were told that.
Mm-hmm. If Cynthia White is dead, the Cynthia White who was the star prosecution witness against Mumia, what would that mean for the case?
It would hurt the case in a number of ways. We have been looking for Cynthia White for 2.5 years because she's valuable to the defense. We believe, and there's ample evidence of this, that Cynthia White, like Veronica Jones, another prostitute who came forward and admitted she lied, lied in return for favors or threats from the police. And we thought if we found Cynthia, she would acknowledge that. Secondly, we are convinced that Cynthia, like a number of prostitutes in that area, was working as an informant for the police. And if that fact were to surface, just that fact alone, would probably get Mumia a new trial, as it did Geronimo Pratt, because the prosecution never informed the defense that Cynthia White, their lead witness, was actually a working informant for the police department.
And did they indicate how Cynthia White died? Was it through natural causes?
Yes, allegedly through natural causes, but under circumstances that indicate that they certainly should have done more of an investigation, certainly taken her fingerprints. She was found unconscious or near death of a drug overdose in an abandoned building in a poor rundown section of Camden. With drug paraphernalia nearby. She never regained consciousness and died. That would lead good investigators, according to our investigator, to believe that the identification papers that she carried might not be identification papers of that person, because in that particular community, papers are ripped off, papers are switched around. People really don't walk around with their own identification papers. So that should have led them to fingerprint the body. And it's only that way in which you can make a positive identification that deceased individual was Cynthia White. And I might point out that in the FBI NCIC documents, they indicated that there were no fingerprints. And that's why they kept the file on Cynthia White open, because the FBI wasn't sure this individual was Cynthia White, so they kept her file open, including her arrest warrants. If they were convinced it was Cynthia White, and that fact was proven through fingerprints, they would have eliminated her file from the computer, because there was no need to keep it running.
And under whose orders was she cremated?
The coroner and the authorities in Camden County. And
it was also interesting, Len, that the medical examiner in Camden County is the former medical examiner in Philadelphia.
Yes, you're right, and had been for 20 years.
It was the first time I had been to Judge Szabo's court, and it's quite amazing to watch this man. I mean, his behavior, people have called him crazy, but he spends some of the time falling asleep, other times really lashing out, telling people to be quiet. And then yesterday, in some real mercurial behavior, he told you would not be able to bring anyone but Pamela Jenkins to testify. And then in the afternoon, when you asked if you could talk to the police officer who had been in jail, who had had a sexual relationship with Pamela Jenkins, he said, yeah, bring her on.
Yes, I know. It is, you're right, Amy. It's a remarkable performance, and it is, it's at the level of a scandal. This man is responsible for a lot of people being in prison, more people on death row than any other sitting judge in the United States, and very little comment is made about it. You saw two rows of press reporters sitting there yesterday in the courtroom while this man shouted, screamed, ranted, and raved. Even Pamela said to him at one point, don't shout at me. And no one will remark about it.
They do remark when they're sitting there. It's just that it doesn't make it to the papers.
Well, and that's why I hardly blame Judge Szabo as Judge Szabo. An elderly man who really is not sitting as a judge because he's over the age that the Constitution allows, but he's specially assigned to sit on this case because he was a trial judge. He's pretty much out of it. But the fact is, until the media begins to report it, as you're doing now, nothing will be done about it.
Well, Len Weinglass, on that note, we do have to wrap up. We'll continue to follow the case because I know you'll be back in court on Monday morning. Len Weinglass is the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. At its annual meeting in San Francisco this week, the 1,000-member U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted a resolution calling for a swift restoration of human rights and democracy in Nigeria and the release of political prisoners. The resolution urges the Clinton administration and Congress to take all practical steps, including economic measures, to achieve the early restoration of democracy in the oil-rich West African state. Joining us now to talk about this resolution, what's going on in Nigeria, also the environment, and what's going on in the U.S. administration and Congress are three people. We're joined by Michael Fleshman, Trade Union and Human Rights Coordinator of the American Committee on Africa and the Africa Fund. Robert Azebola joins us, president of the Niger Delta Human and Environmental Rescue Organization based in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, which is the largest town in the Delta, the main Nigerian oil fields. And Steve Kretzman is with us from Project Underground, which is based in Berkeley, California. Welcome all to Democracy Now! Michael Fleshman, let's start with you on this resolution of the mayors. How did this happen, mayors of this country deciding on, well, what they would like to see as U.S. policy towards Nigeria?
Well, mayors around the United States, Amy, as you might recall, were in the forefront of the campaign to impose sanctions against apartheid South Africa in the 70s and 80s. We've worked with the U.S. Conference of Mayors for many, many, many years, providing information, providing analysis, responding to questions from mayors around the country. And because we've, for the past few years, have put tremendous resources into the campaign to support the restoration of human rights and democracy and environmental justice in Nigeria, we, of course, have been providing the mayors and the U.S. Conference of Mayors with information about the human and environmental crisis there. And we brought to the conference's meeting this past week in the San Francisco area a draft of a resolution that picked up immediate strong sponsorship from some of the key leaders in the Conference of Mayors. And our executive director, Jennifer Davis, was out at the meeting, spoke to the resolution, and we were very gratified to see that on Tuesday it was adopted by acclaim by the Conference of Mayors and establishes policy for that body.
Steve Kretzmann.
I think what's really interesting is what we're seeing now growing in the United States is a real grassroots movement for Nigerian democracy and really for corporate accountability in Nigeria. People were initially, I think, made aware of the problems in Nigeria through the execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa and the eight other Ogoni in November of 1995. And now what we're seeing is grassroots groups cropping up all over the United States. We currently have resolutions in about eight different cities across the U.S., and we're working on sanctions in various different cities around the country. So,
what do you mean sanctions?
Well, mostly selective purchasing laws is what's being discussed. So these laws would, for instance, forbid a municipality or a locality from purchasing goods and services from any company that does business in Nigeria. This is the kind of resolution that's already passed in Oakland. We're working on something similar in New York City. There's already a non-binding resolution in New York City. Something similar, we hope, will pass in Berkeley next week. Things are going very well, so it's...
What's amazing to me is that this grassroots movement is building around Nigeria, and yet in the press, for instance, in the New York Times, all the focus on democracy seems to be with what's happening in the Congo, and almost no attention to the Nigerian situation with the thousands of political prisoners that exist in that country. What do you make of this, the focus on the Congo versus what's going on in Nigeria?
Unfortunately, the mainstream U.S. media tends to only have one Africa slot, and that usually tends to be taken up by issues of crisis, death, destruction, absolute turmoil. Obviously, you could argue that, and it is the case, that Nigeria is absolutely a nation in crisis today. But unfortunately, what we saw, for instance, around the execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa was that the only time that Nigeria really comes up and above the map is when, we actually have bodies on the ground, bodies of activists or et cetera. Having said that, things are definitely getting better. It's very different than it was 3 years ago. 3 years ago, when Ken Saro-Wiwa was in the United States for the last time, WBAI in New York was the only radio station that actually had him on at the time. So things have definitely improved. Robert Asebola is here, and he's had a great tour.
Right. Yep. We played Ken Saro-Wiwa's words when he was with us on the morning show on Pacifica Station WBAI. We played that on Democracy Now. Robert Asebola, he was a friend of yours, Ken Saro-Wiwa, and the story of the Ogoni in prison continue. I don't think a lot of people realize that in addition to the nine people who are executed, including Ken Saro-Wiwa, leader of MOSAP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni people, that there are 19 Ogoni that are now in jail who've been there since or before Ken and his allies were imprisoned, before they were killed.
Yeah, it's actually true that 19 Ogonis are actually in detention since Ken Saro-Wiwa was executed. But it's not only the 19 Ogonis that are presently undergoing detention in various detention cells in Nigeria. Presently, about 81 other Ogonis are undergoing some form of inhuman detention in one detention cell or the other, thousands of Ogonis have died in the process of the campaign for human rights and environmental rights in the Niger Delta. And the case of the 19 Ogonis is actually very pathetic because they are facing the same charge. They are going to be before the same judge. Same judge is going to take up their matter, and the same tribunal is going to handle their matter also. So they are facing the same fate that Ken Saro-Wiwa actually suffered. And this kind of thing is going to happen again. It has happened, and the world was unable to save Ken Saro-Wiwa's life, and it's also going to happen now, and the world is sleeping. You know, that is what we are talking about, because those people in detention, they are actually undergoing the form of degrading treatment that has never been meted to anybody in modern times. You know, take for example, one of them, Chief Babina Vizo, who is 47 years old, is totally blind as a result of tear gas and torture he has received from the Nigerian military authorities. And then one of them who has been added recently to make them 20, Kete, has his two fingers cut off as a result of torture. You know, that kind of degraded treatment is being meted out to some group of persons because of their political belief, because of the belief for their environmental rights and their human rights. And the world is sleeping. Until they are executed, the world will not do anything. And that is what we are saying, that the world should try and come up and do something about it. The Shell is complicated in this kind of thing, you know, because the Ogoni people, two of them have actually confessed that they were actually arrested by Shell police. Shell imports arms into Nigeria and arms the Nigerian police to brutalize people. It kills people. It pumps oil under
gum. You said Shell imports arms?
Yeah, it imports arms into Nigeria. It arms the Nigerian police against the Nigerian people. And it has been confirmed, and they are not denying this. They have also agreed that they import arms, but that they imported small quantity of ammunition.
This is a really important point. It's not only the Nigerian military cracking down on some minority activists. It's also Shell in the Niger Delta that maintains and operates their own independent police force that is affiliated with but independent from the Nigerian police force. They admit that they have imported arms that they for the use of that police force. They maintain that those arms are only used to, quote-unquote, protect their facilities. Activists throughout the Delta and individuals that you interview talk about the fact that routine brutalization and excesses undertaken by this corporate police force that goes on. In my recent investigation there, I was in the Niger Delta in April and was stopped on the street by a man who came up and said, I'm Shell Police. Shows me an ID card that says Shell Petroleum Development Corporation with a little picture of him in a Nigerian police uniform. You know, I mean, it's important to note that, for instance, the Ogoni 19, two of them have talked about how their arrest and detention was at the hands of Shell police. The Shell police came and sought them out and said that we cannot, they said to them that we are singling you out because you are Ogoni and because you have hindered our operations throughout Ogoni, and you will not be free until you stop hindering our operations in Ogoni. We have sworn testimony to this effect. So it's clearly just beyond an internal domestic situation.
Who in the United States government, either in Congress or in the administration, are the defenders of Shell or the Nigerian military? I know, for instance, when Amy and I both covered Haiti, Bob Dole played a very, very instrumental role in defending General Cedras and the coup leaders there. And there are always one group within the government that is the most defenders of these kinds of atrocities.
Well, let me respond to that by saying
Michael Fleshman of Africa, of the American Committee on Africa.
That the Nigerian military, in conjunction with the three big oil companies that operate in Nigeria, have bought the best friends that money can buy in Congress and in the administration. The Abacha government has a public relations campaign that they're funding to the tune of about $12 or $15 million this year. That comes on top of all the arm twisting that the big oil companies are doing on the Hill. And they have some pretty prominent defenders, as you say, probably the most prominent person being Illinois Senator Carol Mosley Braun, who really seems to be operating almost a public relations operation for the Abacha military dictatorship.
Which is extremely significant also, mm-hmm. because she's the only African-American in the Senate.
That's exactly right, and there is a kind of racist assumption, I think, in Congress that African issues are quote-unquote black issues, and there's a tendency, I think, in the Senate to defer to Senator Mosley Braun on this issue, and that's very unfortunate given her her long history of support for very negative forces in Africa, including General Abacha.
Well, that's not surprising. Again, when Amy and I both covered Haiti for many years, one of the chief lobbyists for the Haitian government, especially under Baby Doc, was Ron Brown, who later became Clinton Secretary of Commerce, and he was the main lobbyist in Washington, usually trying to guarantee he would deliver the Black Caucus on the side of the coup leaders.
And the Congressional Black Caucus is divided on this. Maxine Waters is very much calling for democracy in Nigeria, but then you have other ones like William Jefferson, who are very much in the pocket of Nigeria.
Well, that's
other Congress members.
That's exactly right. We were extremely gratified to see that that New Jersey Congressman Donald Payne has reintroduced his very good sanctions legislation in the Congress this session. It is a bill that does not impose the kind of comprehensive oil sanctions that we think is actually required to help restore democracy in Nigeria and in the environmental depredations in the Niger Delta area. But it does include a very important sanction, which would be a ban on new U.S. corporate investment. That's particularly significant, as we read today in the New York Times, about the fuel shortages inside Nigeria, because the Mobil Oil Company has launched an about $4 billion expansion plan, including the construction of a brand new high-volume, high-tech refinery that, if built and launched, would largely immunize the Abacha military from effective international sanctions.
Robert Asibola, I'd like to ask you, what has been the impact on the popular movement by the waves of repression by the military?
And personally on you?
Yeah, it has been difficult on the Nigerian people, actually, because the Nigerian government, the military junta, has a lot of wealth from crude oil, and it doesn't actually care on what the people say, because the people do not matter to them. The people's taxes do not matter. It's unlike in the state where you have your voice because you pay taxes to the central government. In Nigeria, taxes do not matter. And the monthly salary of the civil servant in Nigeria is hardly enough to take care of a family of two persons in a week, you know. So the government has a lot of leverage, you know. The oil companies, Shell, Mobil, and the Chevron, and Egypt, you know, they have a lot of leverage on the Nigerian government. And the government actually gets 96% of its annual budget from crude oil alone, you know. So they don't actually care on what is happening to the Nigerian people. And they are able to import arms. These arms comes from the West and the developed countries, and they are able to use those arms to arm the Nigerian military to repress the Nigerian people. So people are actually bitter about what is happening. They are not only bitter with the Nigerian government, they are also bitter with the West, you know, because they think that the West is also contributing to what is happening to them. And we also think that the conscience of democracy lies in America. You know, America is a center where everybody looks upon as the center of democracy. And such a human tragedy is taking place in the West, I mean, in an African country, the giant of Africa that is supposed to be. And then the American people are buying crude oil from Shell, and the Nigerian government. Actually, it pains the Nigerian people to note that 50% of the annual production of the Nigerian, petroleum production in Nigeria is consumed in the United States. So each time gas is pumped into anybody's car in the States, it is the gas of it is the blood of people who are crying in the Niger Delta, people who have been under subjugation for over 40 years now, and they are still undergoing that kind of subjugation. The environment has been devastated. Today, the animal population in the Niger Delta has drastically reduced, and we know that it is also the Niger Delta is the last refuge for world's rare animals. Insects population have reduced, no food crops, the air is polluted 24 hours. For the past 40 years, Shell has been flaring gas in the Niger Delta, you know, killing people, brutalizing people, and doing all sorts of things that they will not do in their native countries.
Robert, is it also true that you've been you've had your license taken away so that that you wouldn't be able to represent the Ogoni 19?
It was not that I had my license taken away and I will not be able to represent the Ogoni 19, but the government has virtually made it impossible for me to continue to go to court to represent them, because when I go there, they get me arrested, lock me up, and detain me, then charge me to court the next day for obstructing a policeman, because I will not allow a policeman to come and arrest a journalist coming to cover the matter. That is what is happening in Nigeria today, that lawyers are arrested and charged to court. Lawyers are now criminals. No, they are now docked, like I have been docked on several occasions. On one other occasion when we tried to mark the anniversary of the execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa, I was arrested and banished from discussing with more than two persons at a time. You know, so it's like an apartheid regime in Nigeria that is taking place. And the world is lying. They are sleeping. You know, they are not doing anything because they are benefiting from the crude oil. It's outrageous to us in Nigeria.
Has there been any impact from the victories in the overthrow of Mobutu across the population in Nigeria? Has that been an inspiration to other folks there?
And yeah, you're going to have to make that answer very brief because we only
have
a few
seconds. Yeah, it will have been an inspiration, but Abacha has succeeded in diverting the attention of that inspiration by storming Sierra Leone now. So they are diverting international attention to that place, and that is what they are trying to do.
I want to thank you all very much for joining us and get some phone numbers or websites, because I'm sure people want to get in touch with you. Michael Fleshman, the Trade Union Human Rights Coordinator of American Committee on Africa and the Africa Fund based here in New York. How can people reach you and also Robert Azebola here in the United States?
Folks can call us at area code 212-962-1210. We can be reached on the Internet by email at Africa Fund, and that will be one word, at igc.apc.org.
And that phone number again is 212-962-1210. You can reach Michael Fleshman and also Robert Azebola. You can leave a message for him there, who is the head of HERO, Human and Environmental Rescue Organization. Steve Kretzman of Project Underground, based in Berkeley, California, especially as these resolutions go through from Berkeley to New York, St. Louis, etc. How can people get in touch with Project Underground?
The number at Project Underground is 510-705-8981, or you can visit our webpage at moles.org.
That's 510-705-8981. Or moles.org on the World Wide Web. Thank you all very much for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at Medicare. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Senate voted this week for a sweeping reform of Medicare, the federally funded universal health care program for the elderly. Like earlier changes to the Social Security system, the Senate voted to increase the age of eligibility for Medicare from 65 to 67 years old. It also called for means testing and the expansion of so-called medical savings accounts, a tax-exempt savings plan to which seniors could put their Medicare money. Joining us to talk about these developments are Diane Archer, the executive director of the Medicare Rights Center, a research and information group based in New York City, and John Hess, formerly a reporter with the New York Times, who's been covering Medicare issues for more than 20 years and is a user himself, that is, a Medicare user. So we're going to begin with Diane Archer. Clarification.
Right.
Diane Archer, tell us exactly what happened in Congress this week.
Well, I mean, I think the Senate is cutting the heart out of Medicare. It's taking health care away from seniors and people with disabilities. Medicare is designed to treat seniors and people with disabilities equally, regardless of their health or their wealth. And now these proposals pit the wealthy against the poor, the sick against the healthy, raising the eligibility age from 65 to 67 is a bad idea. The proposal is projected to leave 200,000 more Americans each year without health insurance. And these are people in their 60s who will likely have substantial health care needs because of their age. So Congress is breaking its commitment to ensure that seniors get health care. As far as means testing Medicare is concerned, the Senate voted to charge wealthy seniors more money for their Medicare, and that's dangerous because it fragments the Medicare program. It makes Medicare less attractive to wealthy seniors and erodes broad-based support for the program. Fortunately, it seems that this proposal is unlikely to pass because the House opposes it. Our view is that if Congress wants to raise money, it should give fewer tax cuts to the wealthy. As far as medical savings accounts are concerned, the offer of medical savings accounts to people on Medicare also, we believe, further erodes and fragments the Medicare program. Basically, the government is planning to buy off wealthy seniors from Medicare by giving them vouchers, a certain amount of money to purchase high-deductible private health insurance themselves. But this is a subsidy for the wealthy who are in good health, because the money they don't spend, they can keep tax-free. It's going to cost the government billions of dollars, but it will take pressure off of Congress to adequately fund the Medicare program for people who aren't wealthy, and most Medicare beneficiaries have quite low incomes.
Well, how would the means test that they're proposing work?
Well, it's not completely clear, but it seems that if you have an income over $50,000 as an individual, and I think it's $75,000 as a couple, you would pay higher premiums is one way it could work, or the other way it could work is if they decide to charge a high deductible, a high out-of-pocket cost for wealthier seniors before they get coverage for their medical expenses.
You know, I think we ought to start at the beginning and point out that there is no Medicare crisis. Why do they say Medicare is going broke? They never say the Army's going broke. They don't say the Navy's going broke. But Medicare is going broke. The fact is that the country is drowning in money. If you read the financial page every day, they're trading 600 million shares a day on the New York Stock Exchange at record prices. So there is no crisis. Also, the government right now, the Congress is voting to cut the capital gains tax. So when they talk about taking a nip off the wealthy old people, That's just a cover.
But John, your old paper, the New York Times, is congratulating the senators, saying they're taking a very brave move, 70 of them beginning to take on the issue of Medicare. They say it would drain the Treasury over the next 10 years of $1.6 trillion because health expenditures are outstripping inflation and because tens of millions of baby boomers are lining up to retire.
Yes, they had a lead in the paper talking about the new proposals as causing the elderly to take a greater responsibility for their medical care. We're being irresponsible if we're insured, and if we are uninsured, we're being responsible for our own. In other words, every man for himself. By the way, I was very amused to see the this distinction they make between the 65s and the others. The ABC News the other night, to show what a person over 65 looks like, pulled a stock shot from a golf course down south, from some very luxurious one. Here's half a dozen guys bursting with health and money. you know, on a golf course, in a golf cart with fringes on top. These are the elderly. There isn't one out of 100 old people could afford it. But the biggest thing I keep trying to say is we're not the targets of all this legislation. The elderly, I'm elderly. I'm old. The real target, as I've been saying it for 20 years, is young people, it's working people, it's our kids and our grandchildren. And the evidence of that is here they're proposing, they put off the bad news for 5 years. Most people wouldn't know what hit them. And beginning in the next century, beginning 5 years from now, a month at a time, they're going to push the age back, which is absolute crime. How could they even be thinking of such a thing? They should be moving Medicare down to prenatal care, for goodness sakes.
Exactly right.
Well, as one of those baby boomers who's been paying into the Social Security system for all these years, and now I'm being told that there's not going to be much money left when I get to retirement age, I have a question. Isn't what we're basically talking about in terms of this crisis essentially the fact that you've got a huge blip in the population in terms of baby boomers, that means that the society, it's a result of World War II. This is what's creating the immediate cash flow problem, that all these babies born after World War II are all coming of retirement age at the same time.
They've been pulling that since Malthus' time 200 years ago. The whole idea is that our government, our country is getting poor, and we can't afford to support these people. What about all this enormous technological revolution that we've been going in? Where is all this money that's pouring into the stock market coming from if we're getting poorer? We're not getting poorer. It's a fiction. We're getting richer.
Well, wealthy people are getting richer.
Absolutely.
But that's individual wealth.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I know. That's what one.
So we're talking about the state, the country, though. We're talking about the wealth of the country.
Well, that's because we're not taxing this wealth. The money is pouring in, and in fact they are cutting the taxes on the wealthy. Further, they're cutting the estate tax. Just Congress this week is voting to cut the estate tax, cut the capital gains tax. And that's what it's really all about. It's all about shifting the burden of government to working people, to our children, not so much to the old people as to our children and their children.
We're talking to John Hess, formerly a reporter with the New York Times, has long been covering Medicare issues and uses Medicare himself. Diane Archer is with us on the telephone, Executive Director of the Medicare Rights Center, which is a research group based here in New York City. Diane, how do you defend that wealthier, older people shouldn't be part of Medicare? It seems very tough because the examples always used are, well, if these people have all this money, why should the state pay for their health care?
Well, the state should have a health care program. The federal government should have a health care program, as John Hess said, that covers everyone, and everybody should pay in according to their ability. And if we had a progressive income tax, that would work very well. The problem with a program that only supports people of low income is that they tend to be weak. Congress doesn't listen to poor people. Mm. We see that, you know, all the time. They don't want to hear from people who are poor. They listen and respond to people in power. So if a Medicare program is broad-based, as Medicare has been for 30 years, then you have a strong voice to support it. But as Congress cuts away at Medicare and pits the wealthy people by giving them more money to buy out of Medicare, by giving them incentives not to want to be part of Medicare, it leaves Medicare weaker because lower-income people, and 75% of Medicare beneficiaries have incomes under $25,000, cannot get their voices heard in Congress.
Yes, under this change, I think it should be noted that healthy people in their 60s, 70s, who are healthy, who don't have big medical bills at the time, and are well-to-do, will find it cheaper to get out of the voluntary part of Medicare. That is the part that pays the doctor bills. They'll save money that way. For various reasons, we don't have to go into detail, so that we will lose thinking of it as an insurance thing, we lose the people who can pay, who cost Medicare less and who can afford to stay in. They'll get out, and only come in if they get sick. It will hurt the program. It hurts the government. Hurts the trade.
And the whole basis of any insurance system is that you spread the risk.
Spread the
That's
risk.
Right.
And therefore lower the cost for everyone.
Yeah, oh, it's a perfectly savage bill, and it's just vicious and mean in its intentions. It's a real Moynihan bill, by the way.
Ted Kennedy, the senator from Massachusetts, and Richard Gephardt wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post called Messing with Medicare, where they talk about the Senate move turning major parts of Medicare over to the tender mercies of private insurance companies and managed care firms. Diane Archer, can you talk about how Medicare is becoming managed care?
Absolutely. I mean, the government has bought into managed care without even looking at how managed care is treating seniors and people with disabilities and providing no incentive for managed care plans to want to attract people in poor health. In fact, the way they're paying them the same amount to treat a healthy person as a person in poor health induces these HMOs to steer clear of people in poor health, not to compete on the way they treat people with cancer or heart disease. As a result, what we're seeing once again is a fragmenting of the Medicare program. The younger, healthier people are joining HMOs. They look good because they're inexpensive, and today they provide additional benefits. But the government, in fact, is paying, believe it or not, more about $300 more per beneficiary enrolled in an HMO today than it pays in traditional Medicare. So this isn't today a cost-saving thing. This is a bait and switch. Congress is inducing people to go in with nice little goodies, low-cost, more benefits, and then it's going to take away the payments to the HMOs, and the premiums will go up, the benefits will go away. As far as consumer protections are concerned, Congress plans to eat away at those consumer protections. Right now, seniors can leave an HMO on a monthly basis if they're not happy with the care they're getting, which is a critical consumer protection until we know that these HMOs are providing good care. John has talked about choice. People cannot make meaningful choices about HMOs today because there's no information about the quality of care they deliver, so they're going in blindly. Unless they can get out on a monthly basis, they can be stuck in there with a bad illness that the HMO is not treating properly for a really long time. Moreover, Congress is cutting away, actually, at appeal rights for people on Medicare. If people are denied care in an HMO, they they want to fight back, they have to wait while the HMO decides whether, in fact, it has made a mistake. Under traditional Medicare, you get your care and you might fight over your coverage, but at least you're being treated. There is a speedy process in place so that people who urgently need care can get a decision from the HMO quickly. Congress is going to allow HMOs to delay that process, though, in this new legislation, which is also very troubling.
Well, if the managed care approach for our seniors is anything like what the Medicaid managed care situation has been, it's going to be a complete disaster because everywhere you see scandals of companies that are ripping off the Medicaid system with their Medicaid managed care. I'd like to, you know, one of the fascinating things to me is a few years ago when President Clinton was trying to get his health insurance plan through, all the insurance companies kept advertising to the American public that the choices that people have would all
choice.
Be limited by big government. And now you've got these managed care plans doing the exact same thing that they were accusing the government of doing. But the companies like it because at least when the government pays, you know you're always going to get the check for your managed care client on time, whereas in
it's
private
all,
insurance and companies and individuals, you might have a little more problem with
it's
that.
It's all perfectly insane because the government program, Medicare and the Medicaid, for that matter, are in principle HMOs there. I mean, but with lots of free choice involved. Their administrative costs are zilch.
2%, that's right, 2%.
Very low, whereas you turn it over to these private companies
it's
and they
20%.
Take 20, 30%.
That's exactly
so,
right.
In fact, there's a tremendous scandal, a wonderful expose in the Wall Street Journal, of all things, last week of this big Columbia outfit and the absolutely criminal conduct of the company in Texas, in this case. But it's natural that private companies will be tempted to cheat and steal on all sides and to deprive people of medical care.
And the government has no money appropriated to oversee these companies. The Healthcare Financing Administration is supposed to be watching over these companies. They don't have any funding to do so.
Diane Archer, we have 30 seconds. What are you proposing?
What am I proposing? That we scrap all these proposals and keep Medicare the way it's been, vital and working well for people 65 and over and people with disabilities.
And John Hess?
Yes, and spread it to everybody.
And spread
everybody.
It to everybody.
Everybody.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. If people want to get information on Medicare and on the push to protect it, Diane Archer, how can they get in touch with the Medicare Rights Center?
They can write us at 1460 Broadway, 8th floor, New York, New York, 10036.
That's 1460 Broadway, New York, New York, 10036. And that is the Medicare Rights Center. Diane Archer is its executive producer. John Hess has been with us, former reporter for the New York Times, now a nightly commentator on the WBAI Pacifica Evening News. Well, Juan, that about does it. If people want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230 to order a cassette. That's 1-800-735-0230. We're now available on the World Wide Web through Real Audio at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our New York engineer. Andy York is in Washington. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!